Hi, everybody. We're going to get started with a great night of talk and music and all kinds of things. I want to just, if you're out there in the fields and ready to come in, great. A couple of quick announcements. Marty must have one. Marty Durlin has an announcement.
I just want to make sure that we all, as we're gathered here before we start these festivities, that we thank Christine and all her committee at WJFF for the great job that they've done. Is your committee here?
Yes.
I'd love to recognize
Let me recognize some of the people. In charge of dinner tonight. I'll recognize him right now. Greg Swartz is over there with the wave, Greg. Greg has done an amazing job on workshops and putting dinner together. Kirk Knuth helped so much organizing this thing. Kevin Greff also is the interim volunteer coordinator at WJFF and is the one in charge of the hydro plant. He's been a volunteer at WJFF since the get-go. He helped build the building, and he was the one responsible for getting just about everybody who's at WJFF, me included. He owns the health food store in town, and you can't go in and buy any food without leaving with a book and a date that you're going to be doing interviewing with somebody that you've never been on the air before. That's Kevin, and Kevin did an amazing job helping us as well. And also, I want to thank Jason Dole, who's right here. Jason Dole organized a lot of the workshops. And Lainey Santoro, who Lainey was the one who fielded all of those calls for housing. The mom over here. The fifth panel. So, and also John Bachman, who's here, helped a whole lot. John did all the layout for a lot of things, and John Bachman is somewhere here. So thanks. And many, 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 many other people helped. We are counting up just how many people from the station came, and I know those of you who've had these kind of things know, you know, some people come, some don't. We have just enormous outpouring of board members and station volunteers and community members. Many of you out here tonight live in our community, and we thank you for coming. So really, it's been a remarkable time, and we want to thank everyone. Some people have been calling and asking if they can come to this night, and we said, yeah, come on, just make a donation when you come. Just to help support this conference. And I think David Knudsen is going to be passing around some bags. David's back here. So if you're just coming for the night, not if you're at a conference, but if you're just coming for the night and want to make a donation to make this conference keep going, and what we're hoping to do is come out of this a little bit ahead so that we can send Moab, Utah on with a little startup cash so that we can really reach out for those diversity issues we talked about this morning. The whole idea is to give scholarship money so that we can get as many people there as we can. So make a donation if you can. It'll help us all out and help us get a great start to next year. Also want to thank Dawn Zuppelli, who's signing tonight. Dawn is from the Rochester IMC, and we were lucky enough to have her. We were looking for somebody, and she walked in and said she signed, and we said, great, we need you. And we swapped registration for signing, and we're thankful that she's here. So thanks to Dawn Zuppelli. Also, really, really, really want to thank WBIX, who has been taping every workshop. WBIX is streaming and taping, so people all over the world can be listening to all of the workshops going on here at this conference. Remarkable that we can have this kind of technology, that people all over the world can be listening to this keynote or last night or this morning or any workshop. So can we give you just a round of applause for WBIX? Thanks so much to all of you for coming and helping out. When Kevin Greff found out that everything he recorded yesterday on his mini disc did not record, we were really thankful to WBIX had recorded everything. Okay, one other note I want to make. The quilt that's behind us tonight, Pete and Toshi Seeger brought this with them. This is a quilt that was made by a group in Boise, Idaho, Peace Quilts, and they donate to Pete. And take some time, come up and look at this. An extraordinary quilt that's back here. Thanks to Peace Quilts for offering that. Just to get started, I want to have Dennis Burke be the one to come up here and introduce Granny D. Dennis Burke co-wrote Granny D's book called Walking Across America in My 90th Year. Dennis was an organizer of Granny D's campaigns, and I'm sure many of you here are on that email list that Dennis Burke has been sending out regularly. We want to thank him for all his work, and we want to invite him up here to introduce Granny D. Please welcome Dennis Burke.
I'll be brief. And after I introduce Zora, she'll speak for about 15 minutes and then bring on Pete. And then after that, I think y'all get to eat. In about January 2nd of 1999, I got an email from a friend who said, and at the time I was executive director of Arizona Common Cause, and our big issue was campaign finance reform. And this friend said, there's an old lady about to die on your desert for your issue, so heads up. And so after poking around, I finally got a hold of her son, you know, who's 64 himself, and said, you know, it can't be done. I mean, we have a tragic situation in Arizona and in the desert states with people trying to cross these deserts to get into this country, and hundreds of people die every year. You know, you've got to talk to your mom. She can't do it. And he said, you talk to her. And so that began a wonderful friendship that continues and is a great part of my life. So she did walk across our deserts, and in introducing her, I just wanted to bear witness to a few things because y'all are in the truth business, and I want to give you some testimony. Did she walk every mile of the 3,200 miles from Pasadena to Washington, D.C.? No, frankly, she cross-country skied the last 100 miles when the snows got too deep. That's a true story. She walked and walked and walked and walked and walked and walked. I could never do it for more than 3 days at a time. She did 10 miles a day. She did it through incredible heat. She did it through incredible sandstorms. Sandstorms so difficult that sometimes, in fact, it literally ripped the door off our support van at one time. But in fact, I think she went through three vans. But she kept going. But what happened was that, as Gandhi teaches us, when you make a sacrifice for what you believe in, people pay attention. And people started paying attention. Frank Bruni from the New York Times caught up with her in about, where was it, in Texas?
El Paso.
And she said, why'd you come out here? And he said, well, he heard some people in Congress saying, watch out, Granny's coming. He thought you better find out what's going on. He came out and interviewed her and did a very serious, very good story. So the nature of her walk started to change. It became very serious. By the time she got to Dallas, she was having serious meetings with the editorial boards of newspapers, including the Dallas Morning News, by the way, who changed their editorial position on campaign finance reform as a result of that meeting. So that's the sort of thing started happening all along the way. By the time she got to Louisville, you know, the hometown of her arch nemesis, Mitch McConnell, they ran her speech, which she gave on the front steps of his office, in full on the front page of their opinion section. So she was having an effect, and hundreds of people, of course, were by that time coming to walk with her from time to time. The email list was growing to thousands, and stories were starting to crop up. This was a little bit before Seattle. I think it was when was Seattle?
99.
Yeah. What? Yeah. This was very early in 99, so it was before the indie media thing was really starting. But we saw the beginning of that. We saw little independent stations and community stations starting to pick up this story when nobody else would. And it grew and it grew and it grew from sometimes little tiny radio stations in the middle of Texas. When she all along the way, she feared the Appalachian range because she hates going uphill. She even hates going up that hill. So that was a nightmare waiting for her, but she got there. And when she got there, it was blizzard conditions, sometimes 10 feet in front of us we couldn't see. So she would walk right in front of the van so that the headlights, she could see where she was going, so she wouldn't drift off the road. She kept going. As I said before, she resorted to cross-country skis, and that happened in Cumberland, Maryland, when the snow got so deep. And the snow plows made the sides of the road unwalkable. So she said, well, send my old skis. I can do that. So there's a C&O canal that runs from Cumberland, Maryland, right down into the heart of D.C., right into Georgetown. And it has an old towpath next to the canal. And so that was her ski path when she got there. And it was a great moment because Mitch McConnell, in responding to all the bad press he'd been getting, said, we'll have campaign finance reform when hell freezes over. So she said, take a picture of this and send it to Mitch. By the time she got to D.C., there were 2,300 people walking with her. Too bad we didn't have more indie media around then, because that was a great day. Jim Hightower and a lot of other people, 12 to 14 members of Congress walked with her those final miles. She spoke in front of the Capitol on the steps to a crowd so large that the Capitol Police kept shuttling us around in different groups. I don't know if they thought we were going to storm our own building or what, but it was kind of tense for a while. But in fact, she got there. She influenced the course of that bill. it wasn't enough just to get there, you know. It had to go through the Senate. And during the Senate debate, which was some weeks after her arrival, and in the meantime, by the way, she was arrested twice, once for reading the Bill of Rights inside the Capitol building, which they didn't recognize and towed her away. And then she came back when it was time for the Senate to debate the bill. She walked continuously around the Capitol building, taking breaks only for cat naps and when those of us who were doing some organizing on the fringes of her could arrange meetings with senators. She met with half the Senate in individual meetings during that time. They did it sometimes, I think, just to get her out of the rain. It was freezing. But she did that. In the last 3 days, she walked continuously, 24 hours a day, in very difficult conditions. But it mattered to do that. It mattered to make that kind of a sacrifice. This past weekend, C-SPAN had a nice retrospective on the passage of the campaign finance reform bill. And the fellow who is the executive editor for Roll Call, which is, you know, the sort of the inside magazine on Capitol Hill, said this. His name is Ed Henry, senior editor, Roll Call. On C-SPAN, he said, "I think it actually comes down to the media's obsession with Granny D more than Senator John McCain, this 91-year-old woman who went around the country stumping for reform. And I think it reached kind of its peak when Granny D showed up in the living room of Tucker Carlson and tried to talk his kids into campaign finance reform." And so there were some great moments. It did pass the Senate. She was in the gallery. And right after it passed, McCain and Feingold met her up in the hallway and knocked her hat off with a big hug. That wasn't the end of it. It had to go to the House of Representatives. She came for that. We thought it was dead for a long time. Then along came Enron and made it a living chance again. It happened on Valentine's Day. She went through all the halls of all the House office buildings, and you know what a labyrinth that is and what amount of walking that is. She handed out Valentines to the members of the House saying, "Don't break our hearts." She had great banners that said the Enron Congress. They made a difference. And a lot of people, including the Senate staff, said our biggest problem in moving this bill was that they would always tell us, the other members of Congress would tell us, people don't care about this bill. We no longer heard that anymore after Granny D. So she made a difference. Ladies and gentlemen, Doris Haddock.
Very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Goodness, what a beautiful evening. Don't we pray that all the people of the world might have such peaceful evenings in peaceful places? But I don't think that is the Pax America a hunter in Washington has in mind. More a Pax Americana of eternal sweatshops and other strifes. Only a well-informed American citizenry can write things. But we must not plan to expect that our news media will get us out of trouble. Our locally owned daily newspapers and broadcasters have been bought out from under us, and the flow of truth to us, always a problem, has dramatically eroded. We simply can't have healthy democratic institutions without a well-informed citizenry. On a local level, we are losing something else, the community. And cultural leadership of those grisly old bears who once ran our newspapers and our stations. Though we often didn't agree with them, they were us, and they nurtured great professionals to act as the conscience, the eyes, and the ears of our communities. But the old bears and their cub reporters are mostly gone. The best editors and reporters are driven out when a major newspaper chain takes over a city's newspaper. 30-inch stories, which are barely sufficient to give citizens the background they need to make intelligent decisions, and to develop wise opinions become 10-inch stories or even live 5-inch container stories seen on the front page or in bulletin boards sections inside. Mr. Gannett, before you go further, let me warn you that as one woman, I say anything less than 5 inches is not to be desired. I'm sorry. Small, useless stories are only part of it. Seasoned journalists are forced out in favor of low-wage wire service rewriters. The news is not something that comes into a city like a parade and can be reported by simple observation and description. Oh, traffic wrecks, house fires, bankruptcies and murders are lovely distractions and can fill quite a few pages. But such items compared to the more highly evolved stories of real journalism are like the stooped over half man, half ape precursors on the evolution scale. A self-governing people requires the most highly evolved arts of journalism. Real news is the product of real journalism. It is not found by attending council and board meetings. It is the careful collection and assembly of sometimes subtle facts. It is the rising up of truth and conscience and outrage. It is the stuff that boards and councils and legislatures must then confront. Yes, little robot reporters can take down notes when shit hits the fan at a public meeting. But the real journalists are the slightly rumpled and red-eyed scribblers, solitary figures at the back of the room. They are the ones to cherish, for they, through long dedication to their beats, happen to be the ones who brought the shit into the room. And they did it for the people and for justice. And they get no respect in the media chains that now employ them, and when they can, discard them. Wherever the big corporate media giants go, we are losing our rumpled heroes. Increasingly, therefore, the only local news items getting to the people are the cherry-picked agendas items decided by board commissioners and the mayors. And those marketing-oriented, uninformed editors who have very little interest in the truths the people need to know. We are talking about the rapacious exploitation of our communities. Some newspaper chains expect a 20 to 40% operating profit from their newspapers and stations. That is colonial exploitation. It takes, but it does not give back to a community. We cannot survive without high journalism. Not if we are to have any chance of being a self-governing people. Not if we are to be well-balanced in our civic considerations and in our selection of leaders and in our support for domestic and foreign policies. So what to do? we are having some success with the work at taking money and corporations out of our elections. Though the recent McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law is no cure-all in that regard. It was an historic change. It chases corporate money out of our federal elections. That law, if we can get proper enforcement, was well worth the battle and my long walk. So what do? We the people can still win battles, though it is exceedingly difficult. The rise of indie media came into the last year of that battle for campaign reform, and it was an important factor in our success. Let me propose that we begin the work of passing another law, one that will prohibit individual or associated corporations from owning more than one newspaper, one broadcast station, or local cable provider. That is strong medicine, but our society clearly needs it. We can do it, as we have done it before, by starting and keeping at it and being ready when the moment comes to push for passage, as it always eventually does. In the immediate term, some of you are already providing the news and information we Americans need. Your radio stations, websites, and independent media centers are rapidly filling the vacuum created by the ever-shrinking 5-inch stories. You are like the secret shortwave transmissions that occupied people can turn to for the truth and for hope. What you are doing is critically important for our national survival as a free peoples. You know what you are doing, and so I can only make a few suggestions on the margin. I urge you to reach out to the good journalists in your community, some of whom are working under horrible constraints at the big newspapers and television stations, and offer them a regular guest microphone so that they can tell the deep stories that they can no longer otherwise report. Secondly, I urge you to be even more aggressive in getting to high school-aged young people, letting them learn the reporting ropes. You have the technology and the dramatic missions they crave. They will never become the robots of the hunter if you enlist them in the cause of truth at early age. Do go out and find those special teachers, often teaching history or civics classes, and get them involved with your station so that they will bring the young people into the fold. Put them on the air, put them on the streets. Remember what your own high school life was like, and think how an indie media center could have saved your pimpled life. Thirdly, I think we do not do enough to outreach to new audiences who need to connect with our message of freedom and hope. If you have not already done so, I urge you to read Nickel and Dimed. It's the story of working for Walmart. Some community radio stations should consider a weekly call-in show for such employees. You could promote it with little bookmarks tucked into the sweaters they have to restack at the stores. Use the Norma Rae image to get people standing up for their rights. This is not a niche market. The largest employer in some states is now Walmart. Before they can join Reverend Billy's Church of No Shopping, They have to understand that they are in the same boat with sweatshop workers around the world. Which brings me to my fourth piece of unsolicited advice. It is not enough to tell people how messed up everything is. If that is all you do in the rising moment of independent media, the largest opportunity will be lost. The most powerful force for freedom, for reform, is always the positive image of the better way of living. Can you project what it is like to live in the world you propose? Most people are realists. Even the men blowing up the mountains of Appalachia for more coal to give us more global warming know what that means, and what they are doing isn't a perfect idea. They say this to our reformers, please, I'm just playing by the rules I found. I need to provide for my family. Our happiness depends upon money, and here's how I get it. Change the rules if you can. I would like to be able to provide happiness for my family in ways that are not destructive. What do you propose? What indeed do we propose? What is our creative vision for life on Earth in the 21st century? We have to project that in realistic ways. From that image comes the message and the passage of laws and the changing of buying habits. Our two biggest levers for change. Reform is driven by dreams. Effective revolutionaries know that. Use a good part of your bandwidth for the positive. Well, that's enough pontification on a night that should have less preaching and more banjo playing, so I'll give you my fifth and final piece of unsolicited advice. We all have a special job to do in the weeks and months ahead. Our Bill of Rights and the remains of our Constitution are under attack. When I walked across the United States for campaign finance reform in hundreds of speeches to groups large and small, I appropriately mentioned that the rows of our war dead were men and women who loved life and did not go off to defend a corrupt system of legalized bribery. They went for an American dream of fairness and freedom and individual rights. What is it if not a treason against their memory for an elected leader to purposefully destroy the Bill of Rights, the right of habeas corpus, the implied rights of privacy, the right to face your accuser, and on, the freedoms that so many lives have worked for and died for? I think treason is a very hard word, and perhaps I shouldn't use it. But there it is. We must steadfastly connect what is going on now with basic American values. And we must do it in our news shows and in our speeches and in our private conversations with our friends and neighbors. We have the patriotic high ground, and we had better use it. Joseph McCarthy rolled on and on and on until Senator Margaret Chase Smith stood in the Senate and ended it by shaming him as an enemy to America's highest values. We don't have too many senators worth piss anymore. But we do have some. And we can do that shaming ourselves. And we must. Not everyone will feel the same way about these things. We must invite them to come and argue with friends. As American, that is my favorite thing, the fact that we can hash it out peacefully and each come to a better understanding which will inform the way we think and the way we vote. We call it democracy. And for all our worries, we've still got it. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Abraham Lake, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. I never thought in 1996, when I started to understand about this corruption in our government, and when in 1999 I decided to walk against it, I didn't know that I would going to be here in 2002. Ooh. And I'm 92. I didn't think I was going to be standing here in a tent introducing my most favorite songster, the man who wrote me the first letter of congratulation when Dennis and I finished the book, which he said that he had changed his life after reading that book. He was out working again. You all know who he is, and you all know that you came here for him. That's why I came. This is Peter Seeger.
You know the song, you can sing it better than I can. To everything there is a season. To everything. Time and a time for every purpose. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to be born, a time to plant, to reap, a time to plant, a time to kill, to heal, a time to kill, a time to laugh, to weep, a time to laugh, a to me. Oh, get some harmony. To there is a season. Turn a time for every purpose. A time to build up, a time to break down. A time to build up, a time to dance, to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, a time to cast away, to gather, a time to gather stones together. A time of war, a time of peace, a time of war. heart. Time of love, of hate, a time of life. A time you may embrace, a time you may refrain. A time to refrain from embrace. To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season. Every purpose and a time to gain, a time to lose, a time to gain, a time to rend, to sow, a time to rend, a time of love, of hate, a time of heart, peace, a time of peace. I swear it's not too late. To everything, turn, turn. It's a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time for every purpose. Julius Lester tells me that those words, originally in Hebrew by a man named Koheleth, were put together around the year 252 BCE. The armies of Alexander the Great had charged through that part of the world on their way to Egypt and left a trail of Greek culture, buildings, poetry. And the style of poetry this is shows Greek influence. Of course, then it was translated in the year 1607 in London into a translation that is so poetic that more people read the Bible in English-speaking countries than in any other part of the world because it has such a fantastic translation. People have wondered if Shakespeare had anything to do it. There's absolutely no paper trail whatsoever. And finally, scholars came to the reluctant conclusion that Shakespeare did not have anything to do with the King James Version of the Bible. But about 15 years ago, I think it was a young woman, thought, Shakespeare was 46 years old in that year. She looked up the 46th Psalm of David, counts 46 words from the beginning. There's the word shake. She counted 46 words from the end of that same psalm, and there's the word spear. That's too much of a coincidence. All I know is that whoever wrote the line, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together, was a very, very, very good poet. None of us know how the world is going to be saved. The human race, we come from millions of years of killing each other. Your ancestors and mine were good fighters. The ones who were not good fighters didn't have descendants. At the same time, we are a very social animal living in groups, and we learn to communicate. Many anthropologists feel that the reason our ancestors defeated the Neanderthals is that we probably had better skills in not only words, but arithmetic. Perhaps somewhere there in Europe. You know, it took several thousand years before there were no more Neanderthals in Europe. I can see up at the top of the valley there's a Neanderthal tribe. At the other end of the valley is tribe of our ancestors. They say, now we attract them down. Five of you get behind that rock. Five of you hide over there in the bushes. And they'll come directly towards us. And when you hear me go, woo, you attack them from both sides.
Sounds like Friday To live in a tribe, though, you have to know how to argue and how to forgive. And inside our chromosomes are not only the urge to use sticks and throw stones, probably the reason we love baseball, but also if we hadn't been very selfish when we were first born and we grabbed for that nipple and started sucking, we wouldn't have lived. But if some people hadn't been very unselfish, we probably would not have survived childhood. So out of all this complicated background, how are we going to save this world? I think your job here has got to figure, what are the things that work? What are the things that don't work? And see that next time you have another gathering, there are twice as many independent radio stations. Every college town should have one. And you might consider how to change the tactics in a big city. You know, about 3 years ago, there was a United Nations conference on urbanization. It was held in Istanbul, because over half the people in the world now live in the cities. And Fidel Castro made an interesting speech. He says, people of the cities have the worst environment of the world, and it's not going to be cleaned up for them. They're going to have to struggle to clean it up. But in this struggle, they will be learning things necessary for the future of the world. In other words, how to work with people of different religions, different ethnic backgrounds, and so on. And I find that what's been going on in New York City in the last 30 years is absolutely fascinating. There have never been so many small organizations working here and there. In Queens, there's a newspaper stand, I'm told, that sells newspapers in 182 languages. And people of the cities are going to show the people of the small towns and the countrysides and the suburbs how to work together. I really do believe. And you can be part of this struggle. Admittedly, the English language is crazy. Josh White read a book by Richard Lederer and put together a rap called Crazy English. English is the widest, most widely used language in the history of the planet. One out of every seven human beings can speak or read it. It has the largest vocabulary, perhaps 2 million words. But face it, English is crazy. Next time, help me out. Just a few examples. There's no egg in eggplant. No pine or apple in pineapple. A writer writes, but do fingers fing? Do grocers gross? Quicksand works slowly. Boxing rings are square. English is crazy. If the plural of tooth is teeth, shouldn't the plural of booth be beef? It's one goose, two geese. Why not one moose, two meese? The plural of index is indices. Should it be one Kleenex, two Kleeneces? English is crazy. Need a little harmony. Crazy. In what other language do you drive on a parkway and park in a driveway? Recite at a play and play at a recital? Ship by truck, send cargo by ship. Have noses that run and feet that smell. English is crazy. You have to marvel at the lunacy of a language in which your house can burn down when it burns up. You fill out a form when you fill it in. Your alarm clock goes off when it goes on. And if a vegetarian eats vegetables, what does a humanitarian eat? English is so crazy. Well, English was made up by people, not computers. Reflects the creativity of the human race. So that's when I wind up my watch, I start it. When I wind up this rap, I end it. English is the race. And I guess you know better than I how, if you're going to reach out to people in a community, you've got to reach out to all kinds of people and find ways, and humor is a good way, to get people to listen to each other, even when they think they disagree violently. Suddenly, they're surprised to find out there's places they agree with each other. The next few decades are going to be so exciting. You're going to see exciting things happen. True, there'll be some terrible things probably, but there's more wonderful little things going on in this country than ever I have seen in all my life. All sorts of little things. We built the big Clearwater 33 years ago. It was a committee of quite a wide-ranging committee, artists, business people, Republicans and Democrats and independents, and history lovers and ecology-type people, young people and old. Now there's a dozen other boats like it, a couple schooners in Chesapeake Bay, a couple in Lake Michigan, several up the New England coast. And now they're finding you don't have to have a huge boat. There's an organization called the Atlantic Challenge, which brings together people who love small wooden boats. 15 feet, 20 feet, 30, at most 40. And in a Dublin, Ireland marine museum, they found a 38-foot rowboat, if you can imagine one. It was a French admiral's longboat. In the year 1798, it got captured when it went ashore in Bantry Bay. Now they've built 40 more like it in Europe, 10 more like it in this country, and they race each other. And here's a typical story. A woman in Tacoma, Washington, the mother of one of the main apprentices in the main apprentice shop, says, "Oh, what a beautiful boat. Send me the plans." She takes it to a boat builder. He says, "Oh, I could build one of these in a year for $20,000 or $30,000. She said, "I don't want you to build it. I want you to show us how to build it." In other words, she wanted to build an organization. It took twice as long. It took them 2 years. But now the boat's out on Tacoma Bay. It's the southern part of Puget Sound. And she gets a phone call. "Can we borrow your Bantry?" She says, "We'd love for you to use it, but you must train 13 people, a bow watch to make sure you don't run into a log, 10 strong people at the oars. Some of the oars are 18 feet long. And don't make them all men. And then you need a navigator who knows all the rules of the road and has a cell phone, and a coxswain to steer. And now it's being used every week. And it's taking the mayor out and the president of the Chamber of Commerce and the head of the Central Trades and Labor Unions and the president of the graduating classes. It's saving Tacoma Bay with nothing more than a beautiful, beautiful rowboat." There are going to be so many surprising things, and you are going to be right in the middle of it, reporting on it and getting people enthusiastic about it. I'll only add one more thing. Keep in mind that the key to the future is what we do, not what we say. And when we get people thinking, how our big job is to find out the right thing to do. Often the right thing to do may seem like a rather trivial thing. Way back in 1955, December 5th, who could say that riding in the front seat of a bus was that important for African Americans? Why, voting is important. Jobs, health, schools are important. Why don't you concentrate on that instead of riding in the front seat of a bus? But they perceived this was something they could win on. Not just attempt to win on, but they could win. And of course, it just so happened that one of the most extraordinary human beings was there. He didn't actually want to lead it. He wanted to write a book. He was a scholar. He'd graduated from high school at age 15, from college at age 19. After divinity school, he wanted to study for 2 more years under some professors of philosophy at Boston University. He was offered 3 very good paying jobs at northern universities. But no, he took a smaller pay job in a little church in Montgomery, Alabama. But he perceived that if he could hold this bus boycott together and win it, that might be the most important thing he could do. And he used all his training, all his energy, and he did the cautious conservative ones, the angry radical ones. He said, we have got to stick together. If we stick together, we can win this. And 13 months later, they did win it. Down in Alabama, 1955. Not all of us here today were then alive. A young Baptist preacher, he was 26, led a bus boycott. He showed a way for a brand new day without firing a shot. Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King, you too can learn to sing, so drop the gun. Got it? You're going to sing it with me. Sing that first line. Don't say it can't be done. Try it. Don't say it can't be done. You got it. Here's the second line. The battle's just begun. Try that. The battle's just begun. Now we put them both together. Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King. Got it? Take it from Dr. King. Now we put all 3 lines together. Just one moment, I gotta shift these gears here. Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King. You too can learn to sing. Got it? You too can learn to sing. Here's the last line. So drop the gun. Got it? So drop the gun. Now we do all 5 lines and you know the chorus. Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King. You too can learn to sing, so drop the gun. Oh, those must have been an exciting 13 years. Young heroes, young heroines. There was laughter, there was tears. Students sitting down at lunch counters. Children dancing in the streets. To think it all started with Rosa refusing to give up her seat. Don't say it can't be done. The battle just begun. Take it from Dr. King. You too can learn to sing, so drop the gun. Songs, songs, songs kept them going and growing. They didn't know all the millions of seeds that they were sowing. They were singing on marches, even singing in jail. Songs gave them courage to believe they would not fail. Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King. You too can learn to sing. So drop the gun. We sang about Alabama, 1955. But since September 11th, many wonder, will this world survive? But if the world learns the lessons from Dr. King, we can survive, we can, we will. And so we sing. Don't say it can't be done. The battle just begun. Take it from Dr.
Saints have got the gun.
Native American love song. Supper's ready.